In the midst of widespread reports of starvation in Gaza due to a U.S.-backed Israeli blockade, there have been many calls for action coming from the UN and various nation states, as well as activists and non-governmental organizations all over the world. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Eric Rubin of People Against Genocide Everywhere and Delinda Hanley of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs about a proposal for an armed force to go into Gaza to put an end to the Israeli assault on the Palestinian territory.
This would be kind of something new. And what would this look like, either one of you who wants to handle this, an actual armed force in Gaza? Not Israeli, not U.S., but a multinational force. Would this be a part of something the U.N. would do, or would it just be individual countries getting together to come up with a combined force?
So basically, we've been working with Craig Bookhiver, who many folks know is an amazing individual. He's been with the U.N. for decades, and he had quit because of the inability of the U.N. to do anything to stop the genocide. And he brought our attention to the Uniting for Peace resolution. What that entails is basically overriding the Security Council. With the Security Council, you would have the blue hats, the peacekeepers. This is fundamentally different. This would be the General Assembly having a vote to bring in Uniting for Peace resolution. That resolution, and there have been actually two since the beginning of October 7th, but with no teeth, basically saying Israel bad, Gaza good. And that was it. The problem has been there are no teeth in it. So this one has, we have specific and very, very clear components of what we want to see in the resolution. At which point, if two-thirds of the General Assembly then agree, what happens is the various countries within the UN then bring in and decide what kind of forces they want to bring in. Troops, ships, planes. These are defensive forces, and they would be used both to stop the genocide in Gaza, and also to open up all the humanitarian routes to the UN without any interference by the U.S. or by Israel.
Delinda, has there been any precedent for this? Have armed troops gone into an area with teeth, as you're putting it?
Yes. In Egypt, it worked to prevent the Suez crisis. There have been armed troops in Lebanon trying to keep the two sides from killing each other. And may I also stress that Palestinians would be able to help figure out what nationalities are part of the troops, right, Eric? Like, they probably don't want Americans, and but, you know, South Africans, Australians, I mean, Irish would be wonderful troops. They get to help select because it's protecting them.
Yes, I think the thing that people need to realize, because I talk to people all the time, and they're like, we never heard of this. Well, actually, nor did I until, you know, Craig Bookhiver was kind enough to share it. The fact of the matter is, as Delinda was saying, not only has it been done before, but interesting enough, it's been done by the U.S. before. And, you know, it was instituted specifically to override Security Council vetoes. And the U.S. has used that mechanism when it was of their interest, but then denied it even existed historically at this point. So just wanted to add that little caveat there, if I may.
So if you're talking about a Suez Canal type situation, the Eisenhower administration just didn't want to allow the British, French, and Israelis to take over the Suez Canal. The U.S. is sitting on top of the world at the time and had the power to do that. But in this situation, the U.S. is totally with the Israelis. So is that going to make a difference if a multinational armed force starts to come in and the U.S. and the Israelis oppose it? What will happen then?
I mean, I think Israel has pretty much shown what it will do. The question is, to what extent will they do that before they stop or are stopped doing it? And the fact that it's an armed defensive group that's being sent in there is for a reason. Israel has shown total disregard for international law. They've shown total disregard for human rights, for life. They've killed professors, they've killed healthcare workers, they've killed UN workers unarmed. So I think anyone that has the belief that this would be, you know, Israel would see the armed troops and hold their hands up and sing Kumbaya is somewhat naive. But at the same time, I think the flip side of that is that without it, we're looking at probably 1.8 million people in Gaza that are still alive either being exterminated or expelled. So yes, they will not give in most probably easily, although there's always the hope that they would. And the fact that this is a defensive force, I think, is a critical component to make people aware of as well.
So if this kind of operation should succeed, would that be a precedent for situations like Yemen and Sudan and the Congo and Myanmar, do you think?
I think it would be a precedent in multiple ways.
I agree. It would give the UN teeth. And in all these decisions, they're trying to do the right thing. And then the U.S. blocks it, or Russia blocks it. The Security Council makes the UN just powerless, toothless. And Israel just ignores things, every resolution that the UN does squeeze through. So we need to give some strength and teeth.
Yeah, I think countries would always make the national sovereignty argument. You don't have the right to do this in our country, that kind of thing.
And we're doing it in Palestine. They do have the right. And this petition has been sent to the PLO ambassador to the UN. We've sent a letter that we want to send to the UN for approval. The UN, I mean, Palestine would have a say, this is their land.
Any support in the U.S. Congress for this kind of plan?
I'm trying to think if any Congress people have signed it. I'm not sure.
And what about the EU? Some of the countries seem to make noise once in a while about the tragedy, but they don't really take action.
I just want to say so many people from the entire world have signed this petition. They want their countries to take action.
I mean, I think one of the biggest problems, to be honest, for 22 months, we've seen people marching in the streets chanting Free Palestine. We've seen governments to different levels, two resolutions, UN resolutions saying Israel bad, Palestine good. And yet the genocide only continues and gets worse. What we're saying is that there's only one thing that invariably is going to change it, and that's merging the people's movement. Where you have millions of people in countries that are chanting an amorphous cry, Free Palestine, that it needs to be focused. And we have a plan that is calling on the world to the people that are protesting to basically demand certain things specifically from the government in three different phases. In fact, this just opened up with mass demonstrations, I believe, in five or six different cities in Colombia. Also, and I just wanted to make sure I'm saying this properly on this, that we have people right now in New Zealand, the UK, Sweden, Algeria, and Holland came on with 19 cities. This is the beginning. We're basically in every country where there's protest. It's a matter of refocusing the protest and with specific demands, which we are very clear on. And it's a phase thing. The first thing has to be done is one country has to call in the General Assembly for a emergency meeting. That's simple. Pick up the phone, call. Within that 24 hours, and all the General Assembly members will then meet. We have put together with Craig Bocheiber a very clear list of what needs to be within that resolution, the Uniting for Peace resolution, and that at every country, people need to be focusing their energy on the federal building, saying this is what we want in it. Once that is done, then, the critical thing is what is each country going to contribute? Because that was getting back to, I believe, your initial question. That point, again, it's the relationship between the people, the millions on the street, and the government who, and every government has their own internal conflicts to make sure that, you know, okay, so Spain, what are you going to give? The people in Spain are going to ask, you know, are you going to give, we have a battleship. You want to give them a battleship? Let's bring a battleship in. How about 5,000 troops? And at that particular juncture, you see the formation of this process coming together. But at every juncture, the pressure must be coming from the people in the streets and putting that pressure with a clear distinction of what needs to be done, at which point the possibility of it happening becomes real.
What about some of the trade relations these countries have with Israel? Will that affect their decision about whether to get involved in this?
I would think they would be able to stop weapons transfers and, you know, do some boycotting at this point, too, if Israel is ignoring UN resolutions and this.
You don't think they would think, well, we don't want to lose this relationship. This is economically beneficial, and regardless of the number of people in the streets in our country, we can't do this? Do you think that would be the thinking of some of these countries?
I mean, I think economically, we're sending so much money to Israel in military aid. It's a win for us. We could save a lot of money. In our current issue of the Washington Report, we're paying way more than $3.8 billion a year. We spent an extra $17.9 billion during Biden's administration during this war. The cost of all these U.S. interventions is huge. I mean, it's a win if we say, okay, halt this war, and we won't send you money. And that would really make Prime Minister Netanyahu listen.
I remember hearing that a 30-second phone call from Biden to Netanyahu could have ended the whole thing early on, and he didn't do it.
I mean, isn't it fascinating that Biden created this, allowed it to continue, financed it, funded it? Donald Trump comes in and continues the tradition. And if you look in Congress, it's one of the few bipartisan things that they hold hands and they agree upon, which is continuing the genocide in Gaza, supporting Israel. And I think people are becoming hip to that now. You're seeing that. I mean, I'm seeing it both with the Democrats and people in the Republican Party now has a very clear split, where a lot of people who voted for Trump voted for him because they thought he was actually going to stop wars and keep money in the states. And they're seeing, sadly, that's not true. And some of, I think, their largest podcasters now are basically supporting, not only calling for an end to the genocide, but supporting the right for Palestine, for its independence, and for recognizing its statehood. This is a genuine change that's happening. The question of trade, though, I'd like to speak to that. I used to be the director of something called the Florida Fair Trade Coalition. And trade has always been the flip side of war. What they can't do in trade, if it doesn't work, it's usually send the troops in. And in this particular case, I think if you look at the Hague group, that there already has been some very clear demarcations as to what those countries, I think what there were 13 countries. I was actually there for those 2 days, not with inside the ministerial, and the other 30 plus countries that were there as guests are talking about. The moment that they begin to seriously stop doing the trading, the historical precedent for the United States has always been, you don't trade with us, we'll bomb you. You don't let us have our exploitation for however we want to do that for those who pay our paychecks, we'll bomb you. Well, that's kind of a different situation now. And I think because of that, you know, when Francesa put forward the question of economics, it holds a lot of meat. But that's a long-term issue. Right now, we're talking about within a month, perhaps, 1.8 million people in Gaza may be exterminated.
And I keep hearing the 14,000 babies may die figure. You think that's pretty accurate?
I think it's probably accurate. I think it's on the end. I mean, I have friends that live in Gaza, who are Palestine. I'm watching people right now. And I think for people who don't know this, you know, I'm watching somebody. It's costing, I think, like $500 for a pound of flour at this point. And I have a friend who's a professor who's there with his two kids and his two nieces because they themselves, they lost their parents because of the genocide. He is feeding his children. And every day I look at him, he's becoming more and more gaunt, as his kids are, as his nieces, nephews are as well. This is a genocide. This is not a famine. This is a forced starvation. And I think that the question, and this is the one thing I ask people to think about, is not to get into the debate as to is it good or bad, or what can we or should we do? What should we do for trade? The only question I think should be on people's minds right now is what can we do at this moment to stop the genocide, to open up the humanitarian aid immediately before another child dies from starvation, before another person dies from a bomb landing on their tent. And I mean, I think that has to be the urgent call for everyone out there who's opposed to this genocide right now, is what can we do in a concrete way to stop this genocide tomorrow? The Uniting for Peace proposal is something tangible, and it can be implemented within a two-week period or less.
Are you at all encouraged by some of the people in Israel, like Ehud Olmert, talking about how Israel is committing war crimes. Does that matter at all? I mean, we know people like Gideon Levy will speak out, but Israeli establishment figures, is that significant?
Speaking of Gideon Levy, he's got a wonderful article in today's Haaretz about this. It's describing the pictures of babies dying of starvation that Israel's criminal local media isn't talking about. It's hiding. And he said, their lack of coverage of Gaza will never be forgotten or forgiven. And we're seeing it in the rest of the year, but rest of the world, but Israelis aren't seeing it. And he writes, these are pictures reminiscent of concentration camp survivors, pictures from the Holocaust. Concealing them is akin to denial of the phenomenon, turning deliberate starvation into a legitimate and acceptable weapon among Israelis. And he concludes, there's only one thing that is worse than deliberate starvation, and that's indifference with which it's received in Israel. And I would also add in the United States. An hour and a half away from Israel by car is the location of a baby who died on Wednesday. His family couldn't find any milk substitute for him. While he died, Channel 12 in Israel was broadcasting a cooking show, and the ratings were excellent.
And what about in this country, people like Tom Friedman, for example, a staunch supporter of Israel, coming out and saying Israel is no longer an ally of the United States as far as he's concerned? Is that going to resonate with some of the other Israel supporters?
I think that every time that someone who has been supportive of Israel learns the truth and then speaks that truth, that it changes the paradigm a little bit more. So, you know, thank goodness for that. And I think that all of that helps. Ultimately, I think that the only thing, and I think that, you know, this is one of the things that Craig Mochaber has also said, fundamentally, it will only change, not out of the good intentions of people, not out of the good intentions of corporations, not out of the moral decency of people or governments, but when they are forced by the people of their country to stand up to do the right thing. And, you know, I mean, we've had so much energy. Sadly, a good portion of it has just been fundamentally misplaced. You know, when you're chanting free Palestine, that's wonderful. But what are you going to do to free them? When you're saying stop the genocide, what are you saying that we need to do to stop the genocide now? And I think that's why what we've seen, and when I was in at the Hague meeting, and I was talking to people and saying, there is something we can do. This uniting for peace. This is real. This is tangible. We need to make our countries do this. It was like people looked at me and it was like, the first thing is like, are you for real? You know, how come we haven't heard of this for 22 months? That's a damn good question, you know? But yes, it is real. And it is something that can be implemented. And it has to be from the grassroots. Within 2 weeks, to give an example, we expect 30 countries of people's movements. When we say people's movements, you've heard of the overland, the two caravans overland. You've heard of the flotillas. These are the groups that have come on board initially. These are the groups who have virtually said, we have been doing what we can symbolically. Now we could do something objectively tangible as well. And that is the heart and soul of the majority of the people out here who have been protesting or even just sitting in front of their television or their computer crying and saying, what can I do? You can get out there. I would recommend, if you can go to our webpage, if you may give a plug on that, it's peopleagainstgenocideeverywhere.org. Again, people, www.peopleagainstgenocideeverywhere.org. On it is a plan, phase one, phase two, phase three. You don't need an organization, okay? We are basically talking about something very simple. A spark can start a prairie fire. We saw that with the Columbia, at the encampments. One day there was one encampment. And how many were there 2 weeks later? They weren't organized. We didn't go through multiple meetings. They didn't go through groups. They didn't go through focus groups. They happened because people knew it had to happen. Same thing with this. With these out there, we're encouraging people, look at the plan. We need to get one country to call for an emergency special session of the General Assembly. That's being worked on today in many, many countries and in 12 countries right now. Today, people are out there with their pots and pans, basically calling for their representatives. Some countries that are friendly, that's saying that they want to help. Some countries that are not so friendly, but their people are saying, and they're saying the call is one call. United Nations, bring in armed troops to stop the genocide, open humanitarian aid today. And, you know, that's where I believe there is hope, you know, and that's what I saw when I was in Bogota. It's like when people saw that there was actually something legitimate, they smiled for the first time.
Other than that, we'd have to adopt some sort of magic strategy and melt all the weapons. That would be a little difficult.
But that would be sweet.
Yeah.
It's something we could dream about. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I have to move on to the next interview. Anything else you want to add?
I would like to really ask your listeners to sign the petition online. It explains exactly, and Craig McIver helped write this petition. Read it. It makes sense. We need more signatures. I wish it had more before. I think we're sending it today, but we will send another with thousands more people.
So if people do a search for that, what would they search for?
Just the UN General Assembly, or they can see it on our website too, on the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs website.
And if you do not get that with the address, if you go to our website, it won't be the first thing that pops up as well. It is important, and it is a mobilizing tool. And we're asking people, when you sign that petition, and please do sign that petition, make that your pledge. Don't make that your ultimate goal. Make that your pledge when you sign that you are going to look at what's there, and you are going to join the people in whatever country you're in to look at the phases and get out there and do that and get more people to sign the petitions and get more people on the streets. That's the relationship. That's what's going to build this. That's fundamentally, we have one task, and that's to try to keep the people in Gaza alive, to try to stop the genocide, to try to get the humanitarian aid in. And I think people need to realize we can do it. There is a way. The petition is a mobilizing tool, and it's a wonderful tool. We have exactly the same demands on that. That petition reflects us. We reflect that, and we're all in this together.
That's Eric Rubin of People Against Genocide Everywhere and Delinda Hanley of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on August 19th, 2025.